Now we may begin. Our first step is to obtain sufficient weapons. I have located a source of pistols in Orvieto, but I will not divulge the details. They have guns and are willing to sell. We have the money, and I will set up the meeting in the months to come. Another ripple of excitement went through the men, but Aldo felt the situation slipping out of control. He never should have agreed. He still couldn't imagine aiming a gun at the chest of a fellow human being. Ironically, it was the fascist youth group, the Balilla, that had taught him to use a gun. It was a terrible shot. Uno continued. I will deliver the money when it's safe to do so. However, I cannot obtain the guns at the same time. If I was apprehended, the fascists would have the proof of guns for money, an illegal transaction. So we must divide the transaction in two steps. The money goes separately from the guns.
Good thinking, Uno. Loudmouth nodded.
Aldo wondered how much the guns cost and where Uno was getting the money. But nobody asked. So, men, after I have delivered the money, we need someone to travel to Orvieto and pick up the guns. Uno scanned the men, and though his face was in shadow, the candlelight flickered on his fine spectacles. Whoever does so will be carrying weapons. If you are caught, you will be arrested. And you can't travel by train to Orvieto because the police watch for us. It would be best to go by bicycle. It's quite a distance, so we need an athlete, a cyclist. Who will ride for us? The men began looking at each other. Then all of the faces turned to Aldo. Uno turned to Aldo last and smiled in a newly fraternal way. Signor Silenzio, you come to our meetings in cycling clothes, and you have the best bicycle. You are young and very fit. Are you perchance an amateur cyclist?
Yes.
Aldo's heart pounded so hard that he couldn't hear himself speak. He had gotten himself into a terrible position. He sensed he had to prove his loyalty after his earlier objection, and Uno's argument in favor nagged at him. Their cause was undeniably just. Signor Silenzio, when the time comes, will you pick up the guns? Aldo's mouth went dry, and his thoughts raced. Maybe this was like a war, a just war. Maybe it was time to act. Maybe he needed to step up like the other men. He had joined them for love of country. He had to be brave enough to fight, as his father had done in the Great War. After all, Aldo was a son of Lazio, of Roma.
Yes, I volunteer, he answered after a moment, for Italy.
Chapter 12. Elisabetta, July 1937. Elisabetta headed through the Piazza di Santa Maria in Trastevere, with her father leaning on her, her dress spattered with vomit. She felt heartsick to remember the disgust on Gualeschi's face, and knew she would never work for the newspaper now. She despaired of the opportunity she had lost, and she felt ashamed that everyone at the restaurant knew about her father. She had never felt so angry at him, but at the same time she felt guilt for her anger. People filled the piazza, enjoying the summer night, and they looked over, talking behind their hands. She spotted some of her classmates and averted her face, hoping they didn't see her. Thank God Marco and Sandro weren't around. She would have been mortified for them to see her this way. Elisabetta and her father left the piazza and joined the throng in the street, where people flowed in and out of shops or sat at tables outside restaurants. Diners turned away when she and her father struggled past. She spotted her house on the corner, with its lemon-yellow facade and wisteria bower over the front door, next to a brass light fixture. It was so picturesque that tourists would often photograph it, and tonight a group was posing in front of her door. Elisabetta approached with her father, and the tourists turned to watch them, pointing and chattering. She couldn't understand what they were saying, but she could guess. She tugged her father to their front door, where she fumbled with the doorknob, helped him inside the entrance hall, and closed the door. She got him to their apartment door, then eased him slowly to the floor. He sat with his back against the wall, falling asleep. He would be too heavy for her to move without her mother's help. She unlocked the door and entered the apartment, but the kitchen was empty, so her mother must have gone to bed. Rico rose from the windowsill in a crouch, his tail curling into a question mark.
Mama, I need help with Papa.
Elisabetta went to the bedroom, and her mother appeared in the threshold wearing her best dark dress, fully made up.
Why are you home so early? Papa came to the restaurant.
Elisabetta noticed a suitcase on the bed.
Are you going somewhere?
Yes. Her mother turned away and picked up the suitcase.
I'm leaving. What?
Elisabetta asked, confused.
Where?
That's not your concern. Her mother stiffened, averting her eyes.
I have to go. I can't stay here anymore. What are you talking about? Where are you going?
Elisabetta spotted her mother's gramophone in its polished wooden case, sitting by the bed. It was her mother's most prized possession.
I'm leaving. Leaving what? Home? For good?
Elisabetta shook her head in disbelief.
But you can't.
I have to. I have one last chance, and I'm taking it. Her mother picked up the suitcase and the gramophone, then walked into the kitchen.
What do you mean?
Elisabetta hurried after her, stricken.
Where are you going?
I've given your father my best years. I'm done. Finished. Her mother grabbed her purse and kept going.
If you're smart, you'll learn from my mistake. Marry well. Mama!
Elisabetta caught her mother's arm, but her mother wrenched it away, almost dropping the gramophone.
Elisabetta, let me go. But you can't just go.
Yes, I can. My mind is made up. Her mother glanced down at her father with contempt.
He's your husband.
I've done enough for him.
But what about me?
Anguished tears filled Elisabetta's eyes.
You can't leave me.
I'm sorry, but I have to. You can take care of yourself. You're a young woman now. You told me that.
What? When?
Elisabetta racked her brain, her thoughts in tumult. What did her mother mean? Was it the brassiere? Was she leaving because of the brassiere? Goodbye. Her mother turned away and hustled through the entrance hall. But Elisabetta dogged her step, grabbed her arm again, and turned her around to face her.
Mama, don't you love me?
Yes.
But not enough to stay.
Her mother's gaze hardened, and her lips seemed to seal. Elisabetta burst into tears. She released her grip. Her arm dropped to her side. Her mother turned her back and left without another word.
Chapter 13. Marco. 25th July, 1937. Marco and Aldo worked behind the counter on a banner day at Bar Girosport, which was packed with regulars, Sandro and his father Massimo, minor party officials, and tifosi. The last stage of the Tour de France was just ending, and the radio played the finish. Everyone listened, holding his breath, and the announcer shouted that Roger Lapébie, a Frenchman, crossed the finish line first, winning the race. The Italian rider Mario Vicini came in second. Marco and everyone else erupted into profanities. Dio no, non è possibile, mamma mia! The customers slumped into their seats and stared into their wine.
Beppe, how did this happen?
One man shouted to Marco's father.
It was Bartali's to win. We were robbed, were we not?
Absolutely.
His father scowled, standing among the tables.
First, Bartali should have won. He won the Giro last year. It was his race, everybody agrees. But after stage 8, his injury became too much for him. He struggled, but could not maintain his lead. That was the end for Bartali. But it wasn't the end for Italy, was it? No, no, it wasn't the end. A new hero emerges, Mario Vicini. His first tour, never even in the Giro. Correct, Beppe?
Esatto, Marco's father nodded.
Imagine Mario Vicini from Emilia-Romagna enters the Tour de France, not affiliated with any team. He proves his worth stage after stage. He finishes second in the general classification.
His father raised his glass.
A toast to Vicini.
A Vicini!
Everyone shouted, toasting. His father nodded.
Vicini should have won, and Lapebi cheated during the mountain stages.
Yes, Lapebi cheated. I heard that spectators pushed him up the hills. I heard that too. The judges penalized him for it. But Lapebi said he didn't want them to do it. They did it of their own volition.
Allow me to clarify this issue legally,
Massimo interjected from his seat next to Sandro.
Lapebi got help from the sidelines. As a lawyer, I will tell you that it was illegal, and Lapebi should have been disqualified.
An excellent point, Signor Simone,
said a party official at the same table, whom Marco had never seen here before.
Lapebi was a victim as well, somebody called out. I heard they sawed his handlebars.
But everyone else chorused in disapproval, telling the customer he was not only wrong but disloyal, maybe even a traitor. The customer shouted back, others joined the hollering, and Marco sensed the mood turning volatile as alcohol and defeat made a bad marriage. Marco raised a glass of red wine.
Everyone, I propose a toast. To Italy.
To Italy!
Everybody joined in, raising his glass. Marco kept talking.
Friends, Italy wasn't robbed today, not to my mind. We have so many treasures here, especially in Rome, treasures that no one can ever take from us.
Bravo, Marco!
Massimo called to him, and Sandro grinned. Marco warmed to his topic, even though Aldo looked at him like he was crazy.
After all, who cares who wins the Tour de France? It's not the Giro d'Italia. We're not French. We're Italian.
The customers burst into joyful chatter.
Yes, we have our own race. The Giro is more difficult and more fair.
Italians don't cheat. We have heart.
Yes,
and we have so many treasures in this amazing city.
Marco thought of the ancient sights he had seen when he rode at night. We walk by them every day, but how often do we really see them? Do we really appreciate them? Agreement rumbled from the room. Marco gestured to the open door.
For example, right outside this bar stands the Ponte Fabrizio, a footbridge built by the ancient Romans, still in use. We inherited it as a legacy from ancient times, even before Christ himself. Such a wonder is our birthright.
The customers nodded and cheered.
And Trajan's Column, rising into the sky, have you ever really examined its figurines? They tell a story. Someone carved those figures. Do you know who? Romans. We Romans.
Marco bubbled over, feeding on the enthusiasm of the customers.
What about the Colosseum, the greatest arena in all the world? Have you noticed the perfection of its design, like a big bowl of Roman sky?
That's true. Marco has grown into a brilliant young man. And a patriot. An excellent cyclist, too, I hear.
Marco beamed.
Here is my point, everybody. Our city was here before the rest of the world. We were first about what matters, not a silly bicycle race, but Western civilization.
Everybody clapped, even Aldo. Marco acknowledged the applause, then caught sight of his father motioning to him from the back of the room, his expression grim. Marco threaded his way through the customers, then entered the hallway where his father took him into the stockroom, closing the door.
Marco, you're making fun of a bicycle race? Calling it silly? That's our stock in trade!
His father smacked him on the side of the head.
I finished 20th in the Giro d'Italia, need I remind you? It was the proudest day of my life.
Papa, Marco felt stung. I was only trying to help. Suddenly the door opened, and Massimo stood smiling in the threshold, gesturing to the party official who was standing next to him.
Beppe, excuse me. Allow me to introduce Commendatore Buonaccorso, who is the commander of the local fascio. He wanted to meet you.
Piacere, Commendatore Buonaccorso, his father said, extending a hand.
Piacere, Beppe, please, call me Romano.
Buonaccorso shook his father's hand, flashing a politician's smile. His eyes were small and brown-black, his pencil mustache shiny with oil, and his nose unfortunately bulbous. He was of average height, reasonably fit, and impeccably groomed, with the creases of his uniform pressed into sharpness.
Romano, to what do I owe the pleasure of this introduction?
Your son Marco is an impressive young man. May I speak with you both?
Chapter 14. Sandro. August 1937. Sandro could barely wait for Professor Levi Civita's lecture to start. The lecture hall was the largest at La Sapienza, filled with university administrators, professors, and staff from the mathematics and physics departments, even in the summertime. He was proud to be sitting with Enzo and the graduate students. Everything was so much more grown up than high school, and he was among the most brilliant mathematicians and physicists of his time. For once, Sandro wasn't at all the smartest person in the room, and the notion electrified him. He had so much more to learn, and they could teach him. Someday he would make a contribution of his own to Italian mathematics. He realized that his mother had been right in that regard, and he knew now what she had meant. God had given him his gift for a reason. Maybe the reason was to give to his country. Professor Levi Civita appeared from the side of the stage and walked to the lectern, and the audience burst into applause. Sandro was charmed by Levi Civita's demeanor and appearance, having seen the great mathematician only once or twice in person. Levi Civita smiled modestly, then adjusted the microphone downward, since he was of remarkably short stature, perhaps 152 centimeters. He had thinning, silvery hair. His face was a small oval, and his eyes twinkled behind his round glasses. He wore an old-fashioned suit with wide lapels, light pinstripes, a stand-up collar, and a silk ascot. Levi Civita began to speak, his voice calm and soft, so that the audience had to lean forward, and Sandro listened, spellbound. He could barely understand in some places, but his attention remained riveted on the professor, and he didn't take notes because he preferred to concentrate. In time, Levi Civita rolled over a blackboard and began to scribble calculations as he spoke. Sandro's mind engaged like never before, so galvanized during the entire lecture that he felt dazed when it ended, and Professor Levi Civita bowed in an old-fashioned way. Sandro leapt to his feet and clapped, and the audience gave Levi Civita a standing ovation that lasted for 15 minutes. Then the faculty and dignitaries surged toward the stage. Students began to file out, flooding the aisles toward the exits, but Sandro was in no hurry, wanting to stay in the room, soaking in the experience for as long as possible.
Sandro, this way.
Enzo touched his arm.
Okay,
Sandro said reluctantly, and he followed Enzo to a side entrance, then heard someone say,
I'll be damned if I'll clap for a dirty Jew.
Sandro stopped. He turned around to see who would say such a thing. But the crowd was moving. Two students who looked old enough to be graduate level stood closest to him, and he sensed they were the likeliest culprits.
What did you just say?
He asked them.
Nothing,
the one answered, with apparent nonchalance. The other shrugged.
Someone just called Professor Levi Civita a dirty Jew.
The insult curdled on Sandro's tongue. His anger emboldened him, even though he was younger than they.
Was it you?
The graduate student shook his head.
We didn't say anything.
Sandro, let it go.
Enzo tugged him forward.
No.
Sandro kept an eye on the graduate students.
If you didn't say it, did you hear it? You must have.
We didn't hear anything either.
The students hurried to the left, and Sandro's sense of fairness prevented him from accusing them further, as he couldn't be sure. He scanned the scholarly, well-dressed audience, appalled that one of them could have uttered the slur. If Sandro had ever wondered what an anti-Semite looked like, he realized that they looked like everybody else.
Come on.
Enzo ushered him out of the auditorium, and they reached the entrance hall, where students flowed around them, leaving the building. Sandro couldn't let it go.
Enzo, didn't you hear that?
Enzo checked his watch.
I have to get home, and you need to pick up your next assignment. Doesn't it surprise you?
Enzo shrugged. Not these days. Anyway, the professor considers himself an agnostic, and his wife is Catholic.
So that's not the point.
Sandro had never thought about whether Levi Civita was Jewish. He guessed now that the professor was Jewish from his name.
Here, let's talk privately.
Enzo took Sandro by the arm and led him to the side wall.
It's his politics.
The professor's? Who even knows his politics?
University professors were required to sign a loyalty oath to fascism 6 years ago. If they didn't, they were fired.
Enzo kept his voice low.
Only 12 out of 1,200 refused to sign. Vito Volterra the Elder was one of them. Volterra was a member of parliament, a socialist, so of course he couldn't have signed. As a result, he was fired.
What does that have to do with Levi Civita?
It's rumored that he wrote the university a letter arguing that mathematics wasn't political, and he didn't feel it was necessary to declare his political beliefs. I heard it caused quite a stir, and ultimately he signed the oath only because he didn't want to be fired.
But he's right. Politics has nothing to do with mathematics. The obvious conclusion is that he's agnostic in religion and politics. It's a consistent position.
Nevertheless, there's a suspicion that he leans left, and his history is against him. People know that way back in 1925, he signed Benedetto Croce's letter protesting fascism, which was published in the newspaper.
So?
Sandro knew about the infamous letter from his father, who disapproved.
Hundreds of university professors, journalists, and artists signed that letter. It's not like Levi Civita was the only one.
I'm just telling you that fascists don't admire the professor as much as you and I do.
Sandro had no idea what to say, given that he himself was a fascist.
But what does it have to do with his being Jewish, anyway? Most Jews are anti-fascist, aren't they?
No, not all,
Sandro shot back, then hesitated. He had been about to reveal that he was Jewish and a fascist, but stopped himself. He didn't know if Enzo was a fascist, but he assumed Enzo was. He also assumed that Enzo was Gentile, since Enzo hadn't reacted to the slur. Sandro assumed there were other Jewish students and professors in the mathematics department, but he had never given it any thought. Suddenly he could see how politics and religion could get bollocksed up, despite their lack of logical connection.
I have to go. Your next assignment is in my mailbox. See you later.
Enzo hurried out the front door. Sandro returned to the hallway and turned left into the mailroom, which was a small square room lined floor to ceiling with wooden mailboxes. Each one had a little glass window and the faculty member's name on a placard. He opened Enzo's mailbox, retrieved the envelope with his assignment, and tucked it in his backpack. He was just about to leave the mailroom when he stopped himself. Sandro scanned the placards on the mailboxes, reading the faculty names, and found the one he was looking for. He took out his notebook and pencil from his backpack, tore off a page and wrote, "Professor Levi Civita, it may be presumptuous of me to write to you, but I felt compelled to do so. I attended your lecture, and I am inspired by you and your love of mathematics. You are a true genius, and obviously a kind and admirable gentleman. It is an honor to work for you, even in my humble capacity, as I am merely a high school student who reports to Enzo Vigorito. I remain your dedicated servant, Alessandro Simone." Sandro folded up the note, put it in the mailbox, and left. Chapter 15. Marco, August 1937. The summer sun was hot, making the thick black fabric of Marco's shirt feel itchy and heavy. But he had to wear his Balilla uniform for his interview at the Fascio, the local fascist party. That day in the stockroom at the bar, Commendatore Buonaccorso had asked him to apply for a job as his assistant, and Marco's father had leapt at the chance that his son would work for the party. Marco was intrigued by the job, even though he knew he would only be a portaborse, a briefcase carrier. He wasn't political at heart, so he wasn't particularly interested in serving fascism, but he knew the job had to pay better than working in the bar. Marco hustled through a bustling Piazza Navona to Palazzo Braschi, the Fascio headquarters, which was housed in what used to be the majestic villa of the aristocratic Braschi family. The grand palazzo anchored the south side of the piazza, and it soared several stories high, with a lovely facade of large gray stones, and on the bottom, narrow, ember-hued bricks. Its vaulted entrance was a courtyard marked by graceful arches in the front and back, large enough to fit old-fashioned horse-drawn carriages. Marco had never been inside, and approached the entrance, flanked by armed guards, with some trepidation. He and the guards exchanged fascist salutes. Then he went ahead to another pair of guards that flanked a glass-doored entrance and exchanged more salutes. The guards took his name, led him to a desk where he checked in, then told him to go upstairs to the topmost floor. He found himself vaguely intimidated as he ascended a magnificent staircase of gray marble, and each landing was inlaid with black marble triangles framed by warm, gold-colored marble. He almost tripped, looking up at the massive dome of a ceiling, decorated with large florets. At its top was an oculus, a circular eye to the sky, which seemed to be watching him. He reached the top floor and approached another reception desk, located in a small room with a floor of multicolored marble and a ceiling covered with friezes of lions, angels, and Roman gods and goddesses. Finally, he was shown into a large office, which was dominated by a polished, carved desk covered with stacks of neat papers. Commendatore Buonaccorso stood up behind the desk, and flanking him were two other officers, one younger and one old. "Duce," Marco said, saluting. Buonaccorso saluted and approached him, extending a hand in his dark uniform with his quicksilver smile. "At ease, Terizzi. Please meet the other officers." He gestured. "On your left is Commandante Spada, and on your right, Commandante Terranova. Gentlemen, this is young Marco Terizzi." "Terizzi," Commandante Spada said stiffly. He was bald with a deeply lined face, gray eyebrows that needed trimming, and short gray hair that stood up like a brush. His demeanor was cranky, and his back was curved like a cooked prawn. "Welcome, Terizzi." Commandante Terranova extended a hand, which Marco shook. He had large eyes that were a light brown, with a strong nose, full lips, and thick curly brown hair. His build was beefy, straining the buttons of his uniform, and his manner relaxed and benign, with an easy smile despite uneven front teeth. "Please, Marco, sit down." Buonaccorso gestured to the fancy chairs across from the desk.
"Thank you."
Marco sat down, and so did Buonaccorso and the others. Buonaccorso nodded.
"Marco, I've been telling these gentlemen about the pride you feel in being Roman.
as you expressed at your father's bar. In addition, we have spoken with Captain Finestra of your Balilla unit, and he reports that you are extremely popular among your peers, and remarkably athletic. Does working for us interest you, Marco?
Yes, of course.
Marco felt honored simply that Buonaccorso would speak to him in such a respectful way.
That is, if you are qualified, Terizzi,
Spada interjected, scowling.
I've had many, many aides in my time here. None has performed to my standards. Even those who do well in Balilla don't take our doctrine as seriously as they should. You must know some of those.
Yes. Marco was one of those, having joked his way through most of their paramilitary drills. Buonaccorso nodded. As Comandante Spada points out, not everybody is up to snuff. I have no idea why we don't attract more young men like you. Do you have any thoughts in that regard? Marco knew how he felt inside. I think that we're required to learn fascist doctrine in school, so sometimes students consider it merely another assignment.
A good point. I'm sure that your father has inspired you, hasn't he?
Yes, Marco answered, though his father talked about cycling more than politics.
Spada interjected again.
This is platitudinous. Let's see how much you really know, Terizzi. Do you know the Decalogue?
I do.
Spada folded his arms.
Recite it, then.
Marco didn't hesitate. The Decalogue of the Young Fascist was a set of 10 fascist precepts, modeled on the 10 Commandments, and he had memorized them from hearing them so many times, in school and at Balilla meetings. He began. Number 1. God and Fatherland. All other affections, all other duties, come afterward. Number 2. He who is not ready to give body and soul to the fatherland and to serve Il Duce without question does not deserve to wear the black shirt, as fascism shuns lukewarm faith and half-measures. Number 3. Marco continued until he had finished a perfect recitation. Buonaccorso smiled.
Bravo.
Terranova nodded.
I agree.
But Spada only narrowed his hooded eyes.
Do those words mean anything to you, boy? Or are they merely something you regurgitate?
They mean everything to me.
Marco knew what they wanted to hear, and he realized that he could read people, even if he couldn't read books. I know how much fascism has done for Italy, and in particular the interest it shows in young people like me. I think it's important to understand that not everybody has a father like I do, one who will take the time to teach them, mold their mind, and build their character.
Buonaccorso nodded.
That's quite right.
Spada leaned over, frowning.
So what's your point, boy?
Marco swallowed hard. My point is, fascism can act as a father to such boys, so they grow into good fascists. Our party can teach those boys how fascism will build a stronger Italy, in the way that Il Duce is a father to our country.
Buonaccorso beamed. Marco, I told them you were a remarkable young man, and you have proved it. Hasn't he, gentlemen?
I agree,
Terranova grinned.
Perhaps.
Spada curled his upper lip.
It's up to you, Romano. He won't be working for me anyway. I'm on my way out.
Buonaccorso turned to Marco.
You have the job, son.
Thank you so much.
Marco felt his chest expand as if he had gotten good grades for a change.
You will come every day until school starts, then in the afternoons. You will run errands and the like, and accompany me as my assistant.
That sounds wonderful.
Marco sensed that a whole new world was opening up to him, one that mattered more than school, one in which he could succeed.
Of course, you will be paid.
Thank you,
Marco said, with newfound pride, and they shook hands all around, sealing the deal.
Chapter 16. Elisabetta, September 1937. Elisabetta was getting dressed for the first day of school turning this way and that in front of the mirror, eyeing her reflection in her dark skirt and brand new brassiere. It was proving a disappointment. It had pretty scalloping at the top, but the cups were shaped like cones in a geometry textbook. She couldn't fill them all the way to the pointed tops, so they crumpled like little frowns. The saleswoman had assured her that the fit was correct, so Elisabetta could only conclude that her breasts were incorrect. She wished she had someone to ask about such matters, but her mother had never come home.
"Rico, what do you think?" she asked, and Rico eyed her with mute sympathy. Elisabetta returned to her reflection and considered stuffing the cups with socks, but that would only worsen matters. She put on the white shirt of her Balilla uniform and buttoned it up, noting with relief that the outline of the brassiere showed underneath, as if proof of its purchase. The brassiere's stiff white cotton was thick enough to mask her nipples, so maybe the other girls would shut their mouths. She finished dressing, fed Rico and her father, and kissed them both goodbye. She picked up her rucksack, left the apartment, and stepped into the sunshine on the noisy, busy street full of businessmen and excited students in their uniforms, making a shifting pattern of black and white. The breeze carried the mild snap of autumn, which invigorated her, and she looked forward to school, her classes, and seeing Marco and Sandro with more regularity. They had seen each other off and on through the summer, but nothing had happened between the three of them, except in her imagination. It seemed ages ago that Sandro had kissed her, and she wondered if romance always came in fits and starts. She hoped her new brassiere would change things. She made her way along streets full of pink and white oleander, blossoming in clay pots, and verdant canopies of ivy bowed with the weight of new growth. The warm gold, orange, and pink stucco of the houses revealed patches of brick underneath, which made them even more charming to her. The grocery and cheese shop were opening for the day, their metal shutters rolling up with a clatter. A newsboy dropped papers outside the tobacconist's with a thump. Elisabetta didn't buy a newspaper, and she hadn't written anything since the debacle with Gualeschi, who had never returned to the restaurant. Nonna had let the matter drop, and Paolo regarded her with pitying eyes, which made her feel worse. In time, she reached the liceo, a nondescript box of gray stucco surrounded by a low stone wall, set off on a cobblestone largo, a small piazza. Students filled the largo, chattering away before the first bell. Elisabetta, Marco called from behind her, and she turned to see him riding up on his bicycle. He jumped off, grinning, as handsome as ever in his black uniform, though he seemed to have grown stronger. His hair glistened darkly with brilliantine, and his tan had deepened, which made his smile even more dazzling. Ciao, Marco kissed her on both cheeks, smelling of pomade, and Elisabetta felt her senses come alive. Marco grinned over her shoulder. And look, here's our Sandro. Ciao, brother. Ciao, amici. Sandro dismounted from his bicycle and turned to Elisabetta, kissing her on both cheeks. Unlike Marco, Sandro smelled of hard soap, and she couldn't decide which scent appealed to her more. Sandro's face had grown longer and leaner, emphasizing his intelligent blue eyes, and his shoulders had broadened, filling out his uniform. Hey, said Sandro, let's get together after school, by the river. Marco nodded. Great idea. Elisabetta, do you have to work? Not until later, Elisabetta answered happily. I'll be there.
Sandro touched her shoulder. I'll bring you supplì, like last time. Do you remember that day? Yes, Elisabetta answered, surprised. What day? Marco asked. But Sandro didn't reply, and just then the bell rang for the start of school. The question lingered unanswered as the three friends were swept into the building. After school, Elisabetta settled into the soft grass of the riverbank, at the spot where her classmates always gathered. Nothing had changed about the place, and the Ponte Rotto stood where it had for centuries, with the Tiber flowing jade green around the surviving arch of the bridge. Her Latin textbook lay open in front of her, but she wasn't getting her homework done, and the page was too bright to read in the sun. She wished for a paper hat, but she had no newspaper, and Sandro wasn't here yet anyway. Meanwhile, Marco was showing off on his bicycle for Angela, and Elisabetta sensed he was trying to make her jealous. If so, it was working, and she felt lost without her female advice column. The other boys played ball, and the girls gossiped in their group, still not including her. But they didn't tease her, so that was progress. Elisabetta spotted Sandro hurrying toward her with a brown paper bag. It looked as if it contained supplì, but she didn't want to get her hopes up. She was coming to understand that she placed too much significance on matters that boys didn't think twice about, which was leading to a generalized restlessness about romance. She tried to put it from her mind. Ciao, she called to him as he got closer. I brought supplì, Sandro said, sitting down beside her. He opened the bag, took out supplì wrapped in wax paper, and handed her one with a napkin. Thank you. Elisabetta accepted the supplì, its breading warm in her fingertips. She felt happy, but tried not to feel too happy. She took a bite of supplì, which tasted cheesy and filling. Meanwhile, Sandro chewed his supplì, which left olive oil shining on his lips, and she found herself noticing his mouth anew. She wondered if he would kiss her again, as he was sitting undeniably close, his hip touching hers, which sent a thrill through her body, though she tried to make normal conversation. So, are you enjoying La Sapienza? Sandro shrugged. I do my assignments and hand them in, but no one gets back to me to tell me if I'm doing well or badly. I know what you mean. The restaurant is the same way. Sandro chewed his supplì. These are so delicious. Is it possible that food can make you feel good? Of course. That is, food and excellent company. Sandro grinned down at her. That's just how I feel. Still, she tried not to get excited. Where's your paper? Sandro cocked his head. I miss your views on the news of the day. No more newspapers. It's all propaganda, and it makes me too angry. Elisabetta had been too embarrassed to tell him about her essay and Gualeschi. I'm reading only books these days. Mostly Grazia Deledda. She's a wonderful author. I've heard of her, but haven't read her. What does she write about? Families and love. People say they're women's books, but I don't agree. Nor do I. I'm interested in such things. I'm learning so much from reading her. Elisabetta warmed to the topic, since Sandro loved to read too. Sadly, she passed away recently, and her last book, Cosima, was published after her death. She won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Did you know that? She was the first Italian woman to win. And you'll be the second. Ha! Elisabetta flushed. He shrugged again. You should write a novel. I bet you can do it.
Do you think so? Isn't that too much to hope for?
Not at all, Sandro grinned. You can write anything you want to. I have faith in you. What do your parents say?
Elisabetta hesitated. Well, my father would say I should try, and my mother, well, she left this summer. She said she wasn't happy, and she didn't want to stay.
Oh, no. Sandro's face fell, and he touched her shoulder. I'm so sorry. What happened? Did your parents have a fight?
No, not really. She just said she had to go.
Elisabetta didn't want to explain to him about her father's drinking, as it was shame upon shame. She doubted Sandro would understand, since his family was so respectable, with a father who was a lawyer and a mother who was a doctor and nobody a drunk. Elisabetta had come to understand that her family was lower class, something she hadn't completely realized before her mother's departure.
When will she come back?
I don't think she will.
Sandro frowned in a sympathetic way.
I'm sure she will.
No, she won't.
Elisabetta could tell from his guileless expression that he couldn't conceive of a mother leaving her own family, because his mother never would.
How do you know?
Elisabetta realized how she knew, and it broke her heart all over again. She took her gramophone, and that was what she loved the most in the world.
So how are you getting along?
Sandro asked, nonplussed.
Fine,
Elisabetta answered, feeling a deep pain inside her chest. She hadn't realized how upset she was until this very moment, and she found herself flashing on her mother walking out the door as if it were happening right now. Tears filmed her eyes, but she blinked them away.
Hey, watch out!
Marco rode over on his bicycle, spraying gravel. His grin vanished when he saw Elisabetta upset.
Betta, what's wrong?
Elisabetta wiped her eyes, as this wasn't the way she had imagined this day to go at all. Sandro answered for her.
Her mother left over the summer.
No.
Marco's eyes flared with outrage, and his heavy eyebrows flew upward.
What kind of mother? That's a disgrace.
Elisabetta cringed.
Let's not talk about it.
You shouldn't shed a tear over her. Not one single tear.
Marco leaned over, took Elisabetta by the arm, and lifted her to her feet.
Come on. You're coming with me. Get on the handlebars. You need cheering up.
No, Marco. Sandro rose and took Elisabetta's other arm, holding her back.
She's upset, and this isn't the time.
Marco, I'm afraid to sit on the handlebars.
Elisabetta was pulled in opposite directions by Sandro and Marco, but not in the way she had hoped.
Boo, Marco waved them off. Sandro, we need to lighten her mood. Elisabetta, if you're afraid of the handlebars, take the seat. I won't take no for an answer.
He lifted Elisabetta, put her onto the seat, and before she or Sandro could stop him, he had jumped on the pedals and was riding off with her.
Put your arms around me.
Marco, go slow.
Elisabetta's hands reached around his waist as they lurched away.
Tighter.
Marco pedaled faster, and they picked up speed, racing along the river.
Here we go, into the sky.
Elisabetta held on tighter, holding Marco from behind. The sudden intimacy made her giddy, and she found herself feeling lighter and freer, with the wind flying through her hair. A burden lifted from her shoulders, one she hadn't realized she had been carrying, and it felt good to let it go. They sped beside the water with the trees whizzing past and the birds flying around and the sun overhead. She experienced what it was like not to feel ashamed, but to simply live her life. Or better yet, the life of every other young girl who came from respectable families and had properly shaped breasts.
"I've been dying to get you on this bicycle,"
Marco called out, laughing, and Elisabetta flushed with happiness. She glanced backward to see Sandro in the distance, shading his eyes with his hand. She felt a pang at leaving him behind, but at the same time let herself be spirited away by Marco, by his emotion, and by hers.
Chapter 17. Marco, September 1937. The crowd mobbed the Termini train station. Music blared from bands, and flags and banners flew. Mussolini was due to arrive in Rome at any moment, having spent the week with Hitler in Berlin. Rallies, parades, and speeches had been scheduled all over the city to celebrate his return. Only dignitaries, officials, and topmost military brass from Palazzo Venezia, the head of national government, and the fascio were authorized to be inside the station, to welcome Mussolini as soon as he disembarked. Each man expected to get a glimpse of Il Duce, except for Marco, who was attending to Comandante Spada at the very back of the crowd, with Commendatore Buonaccorso and Commandante Terranova.
"Here you go, sir."
Marco took the cap off the bottle and poured water in a glass for Spada, who had decided that he was thirsty. Marco had found himself indentured to the old man, as Spada's list of needs never ended and Buonaccorso's were relatively few. Spada tried Marco's patience at every turn, demanding his espresso blazing hot, his tea medium cool, and his biscotti warm from the morning bake. Spada squinted at the bottle.
"Boy, is this water sparkling, as I asked?"
"Yes, sir, it's sparkling."
Marco hoisted the bottle to show him, but Spada only frowned.
"You can't expect me to see that label in this light, with my eyes."
"Sorry, sir."
"You know sparkling improves my digestion."
"Yes, sir."
Marco masked his repugnance, since after Spada drank his sparkling water, he customarily emitted a fetid belch.
"Hurry up, boy, I can barely swallow, I'm so parched."
"Here we go."
Marco handed the glass to the old man, who took it but didn't drink.
"Are you sure this glass is clean, boy? I loathe a dusty glass."
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Dust is the last thing I need in my throat right now."
"I understand, sir. The glass has no dust inside."
"Did you wipe it out first?"
"Yes, of course," Marco said. But it was a lie.
Spada finally sipped some water, and Marco consoled himself with the knowledge that the old man was set to retire. Marco was counting the days until then, and the fascio planned to throw Spada a retirement party at a local restaurant. Marco looked forward to celebrating all night. Buonaccorso turned to Terranova.
"I think Il Duce's trip was a stunning success, don't you? The newspaper accounts were favorable, and the photos even better."
"I quite agree," Terranova answered, smiling.
"I don't,"
Spada sniffed, holding his water glass.
"I'll never like the Germans, and they'll never like us. They regard us as inferiors. I don't trust them."
Buonaccorso dismissed him with a wave.
"But it was almost a week-long visit, Spada. That's unprecedented. Parades, tours, and the big speech in the Olympic Stadium. 1 million spectators, despite the rain. Il Duce spoke in German. Isn't that incredible?"
"Yeah, they mocked his accent, those bastards. Instead of yelling Il Duce, they yelled Il Dusche. It means shower in German, and it was raining."
Spada sneered.
"How I abhor the German language. All that clacking gives me a headache. Thank God I don't hear as well as I used to."
"Don't be so contrary, Spada. Be open-minded."
"Too late.
The National Socialists imitate everything we do. The youth group, the propaganda ministry, we did it all first. They ape us. It's been that way from the beginning. Hitler copied the March on Rome for his feckless beer hall putsch, and all he did was get thrown in jail. They stole the ancient Roman salute from us, too, for their Sieg Heil. And we're stealing the goose step from them, calling it the Passo Romano. Bonaccorso chuckled. Anyway, Il Duce is far too clever for Hitler. Il Duce has more strength in his little finger than Hitler has in his whole body. Il Duce's aggression in Ethiopia is the reason we won that war. He'll use the Nazis to serve our purposes, you'll see. Let's hope so, Spada shot back, and Marco mentally filed it away. Working here, he learned so much about the party, met important officials, and memorized every name, fact, and figure. He had even managed to hide his inability to read when he'd been asked to organize a file system for the fascist bills. He couldn't read the bills or vendors' names, but he could match them by color and appearance. He was never tasked with taking notes, as his boss employed a secretary for such purposes, a redhead who wasn't nearly as pretty as Elisabetta. Marco wished he could get Elisabetta off his mind, but he couldn't. He had been enticing her by jealousy, when he should have been more straightforward. He kept expecting her to throw herself at him, like Angela and the other girls did. But that wasn't happening. Perhaps he needed to be more aggressive, like Il Duce with Ethiopia, and press his suit like a campaign in war. He wouldn't win her if he didn't try harder. It was time to start. Chapter 18. Aldo. October 1937. Aldo concealed his anguish as he sat with his back against the frigid wall of the crypt. He could barely listen while Uno and the others talked away, discussing the particulars of Operation First Strike. Aldo had done nothing the past few months but worry about the attack on Spada's retirement party, for in a horrifying turn of events, Marco had gotten a job at the fascio working for the top brass, which put him directly in harm's way. Aldo had been trying to figure out what to do, but he hadn't come up with any answers. He tossed and turned, night after night. Some days he could barely keep down a meal, and he lost weight and muscle mass. His father told him to eat more liver. His mother worried that he was ill, and Marco thought he was lovesick, still believing he had a secret love affair. Meanwhile, every night at dinner, his brother regaled his family with funny stories about the cranky Spada and others at the fascio, which made Aldo more and more fearful. He had tried to convince Marco to quit the job, saying that it was boring to be a porta borse, but that hadn't worked. Marco liked the salary, and Aldo sensed that his brother's self-esteem was growing in his new job in alarming ways. Aldo hated that his political beliefs were diametrically opposed to those of his younger brother, in addition to his father, but that was the least of his concerns, with Marco's very life endangered by Operation First Strike. Aldo prayed every morning at Mass for God to show him a way out of the situation, or send him a sign, but so far nothing had appeared. Aldo considered his options, but there were none. He couldn't reveal to Marco that he himself was an anti-fascist, for fear of compromising his brother. Nor could he quit the anti-fascists, for then he'd be unable to learn the details of Operation First Strike. The more he knew, the better he could protect Marco when the time came. The anti-fascists had no idea of his inner conflict, for none of them knew the other's real names or identities. So they didn't know that his brother worked at the fascio. Everybody quiet down, Uno was saying. We remain on our countdown to Operation First Strike at Spada's retirement party. I have made progress since we last met. I can now announce to you that I have already delivered the money to buy the guns. So we've accomplished our first step. The thought made Aldo sick to his stomach. He was a step closer to his ride to Orvieto. He had pledged to pick up the guns that could kill his own brother. he felt his face drain of blood, and he knew he must look like a ghost in the crypt. He didn't think anyone noticed, for they generally didn't notice him, and they were so excited about Uno's announcement. Only Loudmouth shouted, "What if they cheat us?" "We will not be cheated, I promise you that. I know our cohorts in Orvieto personally, and I vouch for them. Now, as for timing, we had to wait through September because of Mussolini's trip to Berlin. As you know, because he took the train from Rome, the route was protected by Army, Ovra, and Blackshirts. It was too dangerous to send Signor Silenzio north to Orvieto." The anti-fascist responded, "Mussolini only did it for the propaganda. There were more pictures than people." Uno shook his head. "True, Mussolini's visit was a stage show, but it increases instability. Danger grows on the world scene, with the agreement between the Germans and the Japanese against the Russians."
"Vaffanculo,"
someone yelled profanely. Uno chuckled. "I agree, friend. However, men, I have made another decision. Even though Mussolini has returned, I believe that we should nevertheless delay in sending Signor Silenzio for our guns." Aldo sent up a prayer of thanks, wondering if this was the sign from God that he had been waiting for. The delay would give him more time to think of a way out of the situation, and he felt a temporary reprieve. He plastered a disappointed expression on his face, not to arouse suspicion and to match the disapproval of the men around him.
"Why wait?"
Loudmouth shouted, and others joined in.
"What's the holdup? We need our weapons. We need time to train and drill with them. My shooting is rusty."
Uno pursed his lips. "Put matters in perspective and in context. Mussolini has signed the agreement, and Italy is officially allied with Germany. Mussolini and Hitler are setting themselves up as defenders of Western values against the threat of the Soviets. We know better."
"They're the threat," hollered the Tsar, "not Bolshevism."
Uno nodded. "Brothers, we need the situation to cool down before Signor Silenzio can travel." Uno turned his spectacled gaze to Aldo. "Signor Silenzio, I know you're ready to go, but I would never risk your safety unduly. Do you understand my reasoning?"
"Yes, Uno," Aldo called to him, masking his relief. "I agree with you. It's better to be prudent now to ensure our success later."
"Exactly." Uno frowned. "By the way, you look like you've been losing weight. Stay strong. We're counting on you." Uno turned to the others. "Now, as far as Spada's retirement party, I have further information. The party is an official function, so no family members of the brass will be in attendance, not even Spada's. I regard this as good news, and you will too. We don't want the blood of wives or children on our hands. They are off limits."
"Good, good," the men chimed in. "We're not animals like they are."
Aldo masked his reaction. Family members were off limits for others, but not for him. If the attack went as planned, he would be an accomplice to his own brother's murder. He could never allow that to happen. Uno continued. "I have it on good authority that Spada is a